Okay, thank you. Forgot last week, but of course, all our learning always is in the chut of the refuah shlemah of all of our chayalim and their safe return of all of our hostages and the success of our army. Okay, let's get started. So here we go. Hold on, let me get my PowerPoint to the beginning. That's where I want to be. Okay, so we are in class number two. Last week we started out, we wanted to get sort of a general idea of the land of Israel, the regions, the roads, the population. We also managed to get to Jerusalem. Today we're going to zero in on some of the major centers in Eretz Israel besides Jerusalem. So we're going to do a little bit of that, not just the regions, but some actual cities. We're going to look at some of the languages that were spoken. And then really the second half is the travel. We're going to travel abroad, largely this time to Babylonia. We will see how much we'll get done. Maybe we'll get to Palmyra and to Adiabene, but if not, we'll do it next time. Okay. But I just want us to have an idea of where things are when we start to do our traveling abroad. Source sheets, by the way, are in the chat if people want them. Okay, but we are, like we said, we're going to talk about Eretz Israel, obviously. But then we are going to move and go into Mesopotamia and into Babylonia, okay, and all of the places on the land between the rivers, right, or really along the river. Later on, okay, probably not in this class, probably next time, but just to understand, we're going to talk about Alexandria, the diaspora in Alexandria. That's very important. We're going to talk about Asia Minor, Cappadocia and Palmyra. Well, Palmyra is really in Syria. I'm going to talk about Adiabene. Okay. And we're also going to get to Rome, which of course is important as our enemy, but there's also a strong Jewish community in Rome. So we're going to look at it from both sides. Okay. So that's just to give us a little bit of a broader picture. But first, like I said, we're going to go back to the land of Israel. We're going to take a look for a minute at languages. Okay. Obviously, when we think about languages and Jewish languages, we know Hebrew is the prime, should be the primary language, right? Hebrew has been kept alive through davening, through learning. But just as Jews always spoke other languages and still speak other languages today, whether they're Jewish languages like Yiddish or Ladino, or they're just the languages of the countries in which they live, same thing is happening in our time period of the Mishnah, of the Gemara. And we have languages that are spoken in the land of Israel and in the diaspora. Aramaic is really the lingua franca of Jews in the land of Israel. It's the lingua franca of pretty much everybody in Babylonia. Greek is the language that everybody's speaking in the Roman Empire. Okay, we think of Latin, but really it's Greek that's the everyday language. Greek is the English of those days. Okay, we have many loan words in rabbinical literature that are coming from Greek, that are coming from Latin. Sometimes as time passes, they got a little bit messed up, right? Later commentaries or manuscript copyright copiers didn't always know the words that were being mentioned and they messed them up. Hey, but if you look deeply enough, if you go into Jastrow or in the other good dictionaries, you can find that Latin root that's hiding in there. Okay, so we have a lot of different languages that are going on. We're going to see evidence of that in archaeology, but we also have evidence of that in our literature, right? So, for example, Gemara and Megillah talks about reading the Megillah. Can you read it in other languages? Which is actually kind of funny when you think about the Megillah, because the Megillah itself has words in it that are not Hebrew, right? Parshandata, right? All these different Persian kinds of words. But you could be Yotzei reading the Megillah if you read it in other languages, right? Take a look at the first source here. One reads the Megillah in Coptic to Copts, in Ivrit to Ivrim, in Elamite to Elamites, in Greek to Greeks. He has fulfilled his obligation. We also know in other sources you can say Shema in different languages, right? We have another source here from a rabbi from Beit Guvrin, right? Some people here might be familiar with Beit Guvrin. Beit Guvrin today is a national park, kind of halfway between Beit Shemesh and Ashdod. It was a Jewish city of Maharishah in Tanakh times, and then it becomes both a Jewish and a Roman city, and has a major amphitheater. And here we have this rabbi, Rabbi Yonatan from Beit Guvrin, who we hear very little from, but we have this great statement from him, and it's great. Because Beit Guvrin was clearly a very cosmopolitan place. Rabbi Yonatan from Beit Guvrin said, four languages are appropriate that the world should use them, and they are these: Greek for song, Latin for war, Syriac, Aramaic for elegies, Hebrew for speech. Now we're going to see, not everybody followed this, but obviously Rabbi Yonatan has an understanding of each of these languages, because he's saying what you should use each one for, right? Greek is good for poetry and for singing, and Latin is all of these languages of war. And he says Hebrew should be used for speech. Not really what's going to happen in his time period, but fascinating that he says that. The rabbis very much are pro-Hebrew, not only, but they're pro-Hebrew. We have a great statement, Rabbi Yochanan, not Rabbi Yonatan. Rabbi Yochanan says the angels don't pray in Aramaic because the angels don't understand Aramaic, right? All kinds of statements like that, pro-Hebrew. Hebrew is what you need. But they also understood the beauty of the Greek language. And that's really a very interesting thing, right? We have the pasuk in the Torah with Noach, Yaft Elokim liyefet, vishkom bo'alei shem. Hashem made things beautiful for Yefet. Yefet is the Greeks, right? And Greek was considered to be a beautiful language visually, also the way it sounds. So you have an opinion, even in the Mishnah, even in the Beit HaMikdash, that you had Greek, right? Take a look at the third source here. In three baskets of the capacity of three seah, they make the appropriation of shekels from the chamber, right? This is about collecting the machatzita shekel, using it for the korbanot, and on them was inscribed Aleph Bet Gimel, right? You wanted to keep track of which shekels were used when, so you would not number, but letter the baskets. Rabbi Yishmael says, no, not Aleph Bet Gimel. Greek was inscribed on them, Alphabet Agamla. Okay, was Rabbi Yishmael right? We don't know, but very interesting that he thinks that that is what was written there. Now, Greek is considered to be beautiful. Greek is also very useful. Okay? When we talk about the rabbis, especially the ones who have important positions like the Nasi, like the patriarch, right? The people who have to deal with the Romans, they need to learn Greek. They have to be able to get out there and to speak to Roman officials and to know what's going on. But they're very much encouraging you to speak Hebrew. So we have a couple of examples of the maid in Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's house. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi obviously knows Greek, but he also wants the regular people not to speak Aramaic, but to speak Hebrew. And here we have this great example, Megillah, the same page as before, Megillah Daf Yudchet 18, about all these examples. I only brought one of them for you, of the rabbis who don't know what words mean. And along comes the maid in Rebbe's house, and she just uses these words just like that, right? We have an example of a matateh, a broom, right? And here we have an example of salsileha. Sages did not know what is meant by salsileha. Get wisdom, salsileha, and it will exalt you, right? What does it mean, lesalsel? One day they heard the maidservant in Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's house talking to a certain man who was twirling his hair, saying to him, how long will you be go on twirling, misalsel your hair, right? So here you have this high language in Mishlei about making your wisdom go up and higher and twirled around, and she's just using it as regular language, right? On the other hand, it seems, and this we mentioned last time when we talked about the region of Yehuda as opposed to the region of the Galil, then the Galil, they were not so careful about their Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic, they spoke Greek, and you have a few places here in the Gemara that are saying, you shouldn't really trust those Galileans because their language is not so good, right? Start with the last source first. We'll go back to the second to last in a minute. One may not allow the people of Beit Shan or the people of Beit Haifa or the people of Tivon, right? All of these are places up in the Galil, to pass before the ark in order to lead the service because they pronounce Aleph as Ayin and Ayin as Aleph. Now, We also, most of us, pronounce Aleph as Ayin and Ayin as Aleph, right? And they go on to say Hey as Chet and Chet as Hey. That's a little bit easier to tell the difference. Most of us, and I am saying us, I mean Ashkenazim, we do not distinguish between Aleph and Ayin. But if you ever speak to a real Taimani, a Taimani Baladi, like a real guy who knows how to pronounce the words, Aleph and Ayin are two separate letters. Okay? And here we're seeing this, that the people of the Galil did not know, were not careful in their pronunciation. The Gemara right before that in Erevin is even harsher. There was a certain person from the Galil who would walk and say to people, "Who has Amar? Who has Amar?" They said to him, "Foolish Galilean, what are you saying? Do you mean a donkey, a chamor? Do you mean wine, chamar? Do you mean wool, amar? Or do you mean a lamb, imar? You're not careful. You don't pronounce your words carefully. We don't know what you're talking about. You're just an ignorant Galilean." Now, you could say, okay, so maybe these are stereotyping and not such pleasant Gemaras, and maybe it's not really true. But if we go to the inscriptions, right, if we go to the archaeology, if you find what's a great source of language is inscriptions in Bate Knesset, because every synagogue from the beginning of time, pretty much, well, not in Masada and Gamla, but pretty soon afterwards, and up until synagogue that was built last week, is going to have an inscription that's going to say, "Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. So and so, for the money that you gave." Right? It might be written differently at different times, but they're always going to have that. And the ones in the Galil are either Aramaic, or as you can see here in this picture on the top, this is from Chamat Tveria. They're in Greek. You have a lot of inscriptions in Greek because that's what the local people are speaking, and also because you have visitors who are giving money coming from overseas or from overland, right? And they want to be able to read what they gave. Right? So you have inscriptions in Greek. You have very few inscriptions in Hebrew. You'll have Aramaic. You'll have Greek. In Yehuda, and this is in the bottom here, is from Susia. Right? Kzachur l'tovah kedushat Rabbi Mary Rabbi Issi HaKohen. Right, this is in Hebrew. You'll have Aramaic, but you'll also have Hebrew. So that stereotype of Yehuda versus Galil, Hebrew versus Aramaic and Greek, it actually is held out by archaeology and things that we find. Okay, let's go into a few specific places, and then we're gonna go, like I said, overseas. So we want to talk a little about places. Last time we talked about Jerusalem. Okay? When Jerusalem is destroyed, the centers move elsewhere. Okay? In the first generation after the destruction, we have Yavne, of course. Didn't really bring so much about Yavne. It's been talked about a lot, but we'll just see where it is. Right down here is modern Yavne, but it's more or less where ancient Yavne was too. Okay. We are going to talk a little about Lud and about Bnei Brak. Okay. Bnei Brak is not the Bnei Brak of today. Okay. It's not so far away. We're going to see in a minute there's not much left of it, but it's basically as part of a very large park called the Ariel Sharon Park, or for those of us who have been around a little bit longer, it's called Chiria. Chiria is a huge garbage dump that's been turned into a beautiful park. This is where Bnei Brak was. Lud is more or less where Lud is today. Okay. What do we know about these various places? Okay. We have a lot of rabbis who are there. Just to give us a few sources, right? We have the very famous, conversation that takes place in Aliyat Nitza in Lod. We have rabbis who gather together, who come up with important decrees and ideas, and this is probably one of the most famous ones. Rabbi Yochanan said in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yotzadak, the sages who discussed this issue counted the votes of those assembled and concluded in the upper house of the house of Nitz, upper story of the house of Nitza in Lod. With regard to all other transgressions in the Torah, if a person is told transgress this prohibition, you will not be killed, he may transgress that prohibition, except for idol worship, forbidden sexual relations, and bloodshed, right? One of the most important ideas that happened in the time of Gezerah. What are the three things that we call Yehareg va'al Yavor? We all know this Gemara, but what we might not know is that Lud is the place where it is being discussed. And this is happening at the time that we're talking about the Great Revolt, and more importantly, the Bar Kokhba Revolt. That's when these centers are really important, and that's why this is very much a topical conversation to be having. Okay. source that we have about B'nai Brak, right? We hear about rabbis in B'nai Brak, and this one we also all know because it comes from the Haggadah on Pesach, although we don't have it in other sources, interestingly. Okay? Pesach, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon were reclining in B'nai Brak, and were telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt that whole night until their students came and said to them, the time of saying the morning Shema has arrived. There are those who interpret this as talking about why they have to be told that it's time for Shema, because they're hiding, because they're in a cave, because they're underground. Again, a time of Shmad, a time of revolt, a time that the Romans are out to get the Jews and they have to be in hiding. Okay, but it gives us a sense that these are important centers where the rabbis are hanging out. Now Lud is a very interesting one. Lud today, certainly for many years, anyone who came to Lud in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, very much a downtrodden city. Even today, you come to Lud and its next door neighbor Ramla, there still are neighborhoods there that look like, most cities don't look like this anymore, but that look like they used to in the 70s and 80s, really these rundown shikunim. But as everywhere in Israel, in Lud and Ramla as well, there's been more development. There are nicer neighborhoods that are being built. There's excavations and new roads that are happening. And in the course of doing that, of course, we uncover amazing things. And one of the really fabulous things that was discovered, this was a long time ago, this was more than 20 years ago, was the floor of an incredibly beautiful mansion. This mosaic was uncovered in the late 90s. It was taken, it was displayed in various museums around the world. It was in the Met in New York. I think it came to Toronto. It went to lots of different places. Finally was brought back to Israel, and with the help of wealthy donors, has been made into a gorgeous museum that talks about the city of Lod and talks about mosaics, right? But it gives us a sense of this is a very, very wealthy city. Was this the house of Jews? We have no proof of that, right? We have this very dramatic mosaic with lots of animals, very, very, very colorful, but it doesn't show us that there was anything Jewish here. It doesn't show us anything non-Jewish. Could be, could not be. One of the things that I think is great that they had in have displayed in the museum is what you see here on the left. It doesn't look very exciting, okay? But this is the footprint of one of the guys who was making the mosaic. This is in the 3rd century of the Common Era, and somehow it got stuck in the plaster, and nobody actually removed it until it was discovered millennia later. Lud was a very wealthy city. It was a city of a lot of important rabbis. It also was a city where we know that there were decrees against the Jews. We have the martyrs of Lud, right? Guys named Papus and Lulianus. Unclear exactly what their martyrdom was, but it seems that it was a place where the Romans put down revolts. It eventually becomes a Roman colony. Okay. And eventually it goes downhill, okay? Because the centers in the Galilee become much more important. First of all, it becomes poorer. Okay? We have a statement in the Medrash in Esther Rabbah that out of 10 measures of poverty in the world, 9 were given to Lud. This is clearly not when this mosaic is being made, but later, right? Cities go up and go down. We also have this very strange Gemara here, right? Gemara in Pesachim. Rabbi Simlai came before Rabbi Yochanan. Now let's remember Rabbi Yochanan, an Amora, okay? So he's living past the time period when Lud is at its peak. He's also an Amora who's living in the north. He's living in Tiberias, in Tveria, okay? And Rabbi Simlai comes and he asks him to teach him this book. You teach me the Sefer Yuchsin, the Book of Genealogies. Right, it's a book of some Medrash. Rabbi Yochanan said, and it was something that wasn't commonly taught. Rabbi Yochanan said to him, "Where are you from?" He said to him, "From Lud." Rabbi Yochanan then asked, "Where are you living now? Where's your present place of residence?" He said to him, "In Nahar Da'a." We're going to come to Nahar Da'a later today. Rabbi Yochanan said to him, "I have a tradition that we teach these subjects neither to Luddites nor to Nahar Da'ans. Certainly not to you who comes from Lud and your residence is in Nahar Da'a." It's a little bit of a strange statement. I don't have an explanation to why he doesn't want to teach somebody from Nahar Da'a, but Lud. It could be that here he is, Rabbi Yochanan. He's a proud Galilean patriot. He's living in Tveria. And he's saying, that time is past, that city. We don't want to talk about those places. Those places have now become very Roman, very pagan. Torah life is now in the north. That's a suggestion that what's going on here. Okay. Just a quick look at B'nai B'rak because we don't have very much to go on in B'nai B'rak. Okay. We know that there was an Arab town here before 1948 called Ibn Ibrak. Okay. B'nai B'rak, Ibn Ibrak, the sons of Brak. Okay. Preserved the name. However, after 1948, it was conquered by us, and essentially it was turned into a very large garbage dump. And anybody who lived in Israel in the 80s and the 90s, even the early 2000s, right? This is a very much a landmark on the main highways, right, as you're traveling from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. And then a few years ago, they made it into this actually amazing park, an environmental park called Ariel Sharon Park. And the environmental side of it is very interesting. We won't go into it right now, but essentially they did very, very little excavation, found very, very little. We found pottery here. No one's ever done a serious excavation in the Tell of B'nai B'rak, which is sad because it would be nice to know what's there. Who knows? One day we never know. Moving up north. Okay. We're not going to go into this very much. This is something that I've taught before, and I'm sure a lot of people know, but we know we have the famous Gemara that talks about the Sanhedrin moving, right? The Sanhedrin is exiled from Jerusalem. We have the famous story of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, give me Yavne and its sages. Sanhedrin moves to Yavne, and then with the Bar Kokhba revolt and the destruction of Judea, the Sanhedrin, as well as many people, move to the north. And it goes from place to place, from Ushah to Shefaram to Beit Shearim to Tzipori, finally ending up in Tiberia, in Tiberias. So we're going to look at two of those places, okay? They're a little less known. Ushah is definitely a little less known. Ushah is the place where the rabbis go to rebuild after the terrible trauma of the Bar Kokhba revolt. And the Bar Kokhba revolt, it is a decimation of the Torah world. Right? We just had Tisha B'Av. We just read Ela Eskera and Arzea Lebanon and all of these keynote that talk about the end, the murder of the Asara Haruge Malchut. And we know that so many important rabbis were killed. The Romans forbid any kind of they forbid smicha. We have Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, who has to go courageously and be someich five rabbis. But basically, we're talking about a shattered generation that has to then begin to rebuild itself. And we have a beautiful conversation about this in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, right? It says at the end of the persecution being the Bar Kokhba revolt, our rabbis assembled in Ushah. They were Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Nechemiah, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. And these are the rabbis that were given smicha by Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, plus a few others. They sent to the elders of the Galilee and said, anyone who is learned, let him come and teach. Anyone who is not learned, let him come and study. Meaning, we're opening the doors. Everybody come because we have to rebuild. And then we have many of these, what are called Takanot Usha, right? These laws, these decrees that were made in Usha, a lot of them dealing with economic matters, because not only is the Torah world shattered, but the economic world, right? A lot of destruction with the Bar Kokhba revolt, and they have to rebuild. And a lot of these things are take care of your children, right? Make sure that you're gonna take care of your parents, husbands and wives. If you're learning the daf yesterday on the daf, we had another one of the Takanot Usha about property of husbands and wives. So just to look at them quickly, Rabbi Eli said that Reish Lakish said in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Bar Chanina, in Usha, the sages instituted a man to stain his sons and daughters when they are minors, right? You wouldn't think you need a takana for that. But in a world where money is scarce, it's hard to make a living. Rabbis need to teach you that you have to support your sons and daughters. Rabbi Eli said that Reish Lakish said in Ushah, the sages institute, in a case of one writes a document stating he is giving all his property as a gift to his sons in his lifetime, he and his wife are sustained from the property till their deaths. You can't give an inheritance, right? We talked today about, a tax shelter. You give away all your inheritance so you can get your Medicaid. But then you have to be supported by your children. Again, a sign of very dire times. And Usha the Sage has instituted that one who dispenses his money to charity should not dispense more than one-fifth. Don't be wasteful. Who knows what's going to happen next? And also, here we have one about study. Rav Yitzchak said, in Usha the Sage has enacted a person should treat his son gently, even if he does not want to study, until his son is 12 years old, right? Different from the Mishnah in Avot that says, get him started already when he's six. From this point forward, he harasses him in all aspects of his life, yored lo tov chayav, in order to force him to study, right? You get a free pass till you're 12, then you better get moving. So again, it's kind of an acknowledgement that life is hard, but we have to learn. What have we found in Usha that remains of all of this Torah life? Not so much. Hey, we have an Arab village called Husha, again, keeping that name, near Shfaram. We saw Shfaram before. There's been excavations that have been ongoing for a few years now, part of the project of creating what's called the Sanhedrin Trail, hey, Shvil HaSanhedrin, and they're discovering that it clearly was a Jewish town. In the picture here, you have a mikveh. We have mikvaot. We not only have mikvaot, we have mikvaot that are near the wine presses, right, telling us that they prepared their wine and their oil in purity. And we have stone vessels, another sign of keeping purity. And the excavations are still going on. Okay, Tveria is very well known. Tzipori is also rather well known. I wanted to talk not about either of these towns, but about the connection between them. Okay, the road between Tzipori, you can see it here, right? This is not a very long walk today. It's a 15-minute drive, 20 minutes if there's traffic. If you were to walk, it'd take you a half a day, right? 6.5 hours. Google Maps, put it in the walking
Powder and anything.
function.
Not really
Awesome.
good.
What?
I know.
Okay, so these are not very far from each other, 30 kilometers apart. Okay, and it's a road that's a well-known road, and it's a road that goes from Akko to Tveria. The rabbis are frequently on this road, and we found no milestones on this road. They're frequently on this road, and so Tveria and Tzipori are sort of these twin cities, which is interesting, right? We think of twin cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, but there's twin cities in rabbinical language too. And I'll just bring you a few examples here. Rabbi Yoshia says, right, in Gittin, you can put a get into a woman's courtyard, and she does not have to be there in order for her to receive the get. So what does Rabbi Yoshia say? Even if she is in Tveria and her courtyard is in Tzipori, or she is in Tzipori and her courtyard is in Tveria, she is divorced. Meaning, you don't have to be so far apart, but this is a great example of what, these are the towns that come to mind. These are the easiest things to say. The fact that the rabbis are always traveling on this road, and we have conversations. This rabbi met this rabbi on the road between Tveria and Tzipori. And here we have a great example of halacha there. There's so many Jews that travel on this road. Rabbi Chanina found a slaughtered young goat between Tveria and Tzipori, and the sages permitted it to him. Okay, we're like, gross, we would never eat that. Think about a world where food is very expensive. You find this nice package of meat. Okay, not packaged. Is it kosher? Is it not kosher? And because there are so many Jews that travel on this road, the assumption is it was dropped there by a Jew. It's kosher. Okay. So this is a well-frequented, well-traveled road. The picture I brought you here is of the main road in Tzipori, inside Tzipori itself. It's not part of this road, but we do have remains of this road. One other nice idea here. Rabbi Yossi said, the Gemara on Shabbos, may my portion be among those who accept Shabbat in Tveria and among those who see Shabbat out in Tzipori. He does not mean that he's going to start his Shabbos in Tveria and then take this very long walk. Obviously, it's outside the Tchum Shabbat. You can't travel so far. He doesn't mean that he's going to do that. What he means is Tveria is very low down. It's in the valley. Okay, so the sun sets earlier there. I want to accept Shabbat early, like they do in Tveria. Tzipori is up on the hill, so you can see the sunset for a long time. Shabbos comes out late. I want to accept Shabbos early. I want to see Shabbos out late. That's what Rabbi Yossi says. Later on in Shutim that we have in Responsa that we have in the Middle Ages, when the questioner or the rabbi who's answering wants to talk about two next door towns, right? We know that usually in Responsa we don't have real names. We have Reuben and Shimon, we have Rachel and Leah. Even the towns, we don't often have the real towns. Instead, they'll say so-and-so is a merchant in Tveria and he has competition in Tzipori, right? They're obviously not Tveria and Tzipori, but that's the terms that come to mind in the rabbinic mind. So it's a nice example. Okay, do a couple more. Migdal is another interesting one where you really need to know where things are. Okay, today there's amazing excavations that are being done in Migdal or in Magdala. It's the same thing. Okay, Migdal is very important. Magdala is very important in the New Testament. Jesus comes there. There's a very wealthy woman who's his patron. Excavations that have been done there in the last 10 years have discovered, there were excavations earlier that showed us the town, but now we have discovered part of the town from before the Churban, from the early first century of the Common Era. We found the Beit Knesset there. We found this fascinating stone there with these pictures of things that were in the Beit HaMikdash. Very interesting what it is. We don't know. Maybe it's like a way for them to remember Yerushalayim, right? But it's clearly a very, very Jewish town. Now, we have this great Gemara in Pesachim that talks about dough rising, okay? Now, and it talks about batzeg cheresh, deaf dough. How do you know if your dough is going to rise? Maybe it didn't rise. How long does it take to rise? So Rabbi Abahu said that Rabbi Shimon bar Ben Lakish said, in the time it takes a person to walk the distance from Migdal Nunya to Tveria, which is a meal. Okay, Rabbi Abahu says, how long does it take for the dough to rise? It takes about as long as walking a meal. Remember last time we talked about a meal. A meal is a little bit less than a mile, hour mile, a little more than a kilometer. How long does it take to walk? Maybe 20 minutes. Okay, that's logical. How long does it take dough to rise, right? Today we make our matzah, we say 18 minutes. That makes a lot of sense. However, between Tveria and Migdal is not a meal. It is a lot more. It's almost 7 kilometers, meaning 4 or 5 mil, and it takes an hour and a half to walk that distance. Now, Rabbi Abahu said that Reish Lakish is from Tveria. He knows how far Migdal is. There's no way he's making that mistake. It doesn't make sense. Somebody's messing up. And if you go to the parallel Gemara in the Yerushalmi, okay, then we see what makes sense. How long, Rabbi Yesom ben Baracha, Rabbi Ula of Caesarea, up to 4 meals walk, right? He also says between he says 4 meals, right? It says between Migdal and Tveria. 4 meal is correct. So the Gemara, the Bavli, didn't know the distances. They liked the explanation that it's 20 minutes. So they took that explanation, but they took the geography and they messed it up, right? You need to know where you are in order to understand what's going on, right? And so the Bavli, far away, doesn't know the distance between Migdal and Tveria. The Yerushalmi does know and gives the actual correct distance. Okay, two last places that we're going to look at, and then we're going to make our way towards Babel. Okay, Caesarea is considered to be Rome in the land of Israel. We have a famous Gemara that talks about how if somebody tells you Caesarea and Jerusalem, they're both doing great, don't believe them. They're both doing terribly, don't believe them. One is up and one is down, believe them, right? Caesarea is the home of the Roman rulers in Eretz Yisrael. After Rome becomes Christian, we have very important Christian bishops, first a guy named Origen, then someone named Eusebius, that are in Caesarea. This is very much a foreign power in the land of Israel, and yet we have very significant sages, as well as Jewish artifacts in Caesarea. Okay, so here in Caesarea, the pictures that I brought you here, the picture on the bottom is of the great amphitheater, Hippodrome, and then becomes an amphitheater in Caesarea, where we think Rabbi Akiva was put to death, right? This terrible story of martyrdom, very much a story of Rome in Caesarea. But we also know that there were synagogues in Caesarea, and you can see in the top here from the many, many, many artifacts that were discovered in Caesarea, we have pictures of menorahs, we have actual menorahs, we have inscriptions in Hebrew, in Aramaic, and we also have references to two of the great rabbis of Caesarea. One of them is Rabbi Oshia, who lives around the year 200 of the Common Era. He's the transitional generation between the Tanaim and the Amoraim. He has his own Braita. He has his own set of Mishnayot, basically. And the other one is Rabbi Abahu, who is a generation later, two generations later. And he also is one of the great rabbis of Caesarea. Both of these rabbis, Rabbi Oshia and Rabbi Abahu, are dealing with polemics against of Christianity against the Jews. Right, so take a look at some of these sources. First of all, we have Rabbi Oshia. Rabbi Oshia was lucky enough that his father was a great rabbi and his grandfather was a great rabbi, and they all knew each other, right? And in this generation post Bar Kokhba, when I think of like a post Holocaust generation, that's rather unusual that he has his father and his grandfather and they learn together. So we have this beautiful phrase, Rami Bar Chama read the verse about him, a threefold cord is not quickly broken, saying this applies to Rabbi Oshia, son of Rabbi Chama, son of Rabbi Bisa, right? All of them great rabbis. But here's where we get to the polemics. Rabbi Oshia, Rabbi Hoshaya, right? Different pronunciations in different texts said, when the Holy One, blessed be He, created Adam, the first man, the ministering angels erred concerning him and sought to proclaim holy before him. Here we have a statement that's saying maybe man is kind of godlike. What did the Holy One, blessed be He, do? He cast a deep slumber upon him, and everyone knew he was merely a man. Okay, very nice, very subtle way of saying there are no men who are gods. Can't be, not possible. Right? Rabbi Abahu has to deal with Eusebius. Eusebius is one of he was the bishop of Caesarea. He knew a lot of Torah. He wrote a book called the Onomasticon about the geography of Eretz Yisrael. He's a formidable foe. And we have a lot of statements from Rabbi Abahu that are against Christianity. And here you have this great statement in Avodah Zarah. It said to Rabbi Abahu, what is different about you sages of Eretz Israel that you know the Bible so well? Rabbi Abahu said to them, we who are situated among you, the heretics, we impose upon ourselves this obligation and analyze verses in depth, right? The rabbis of Eretz Israel seems new Tanakh better than the rabbis of Babel because they had to have these arguments, these disputations with the Christians, which the rabbis of Babel, they didn't have Christians. They had other issues, but they didn't have Christians. Okay. Two other things, well, one other polemic and then one other beautiful statement. Yishmot Rabbah, I am the Lord your God, Rabbi Abahu said, this is very not subtle at all. A king of flesh and blood may have a father, a brother, or a son to share in or dispute his sovereignty, but the Lord says, I am the Lord your God, I am the first. I have no father. I am the last. I have no brother. Beside me, there is no God. I have no son. Okay. It's pretty straight up, right? And in the three, right? Very much alluding to Christianity. Rabbi Abahu passed away. The pillars of Caesarea ran with water. Okay? He was somebody who was really a very significant part of the community. Interestingly, he's the one, their very famous statement that we have in Brachot about Balei Tshuva. Right, in the place of Balei Tshuva stand, tzaddikim gmurim cannot stand, right? They Balei Tshuva are above everyone else. Rabbi Abahu is living in a world that's not black and white at all, that has a lot of gray, that has Christians, that has pagans, that has Balei Tshuva, that has people who don't know how to read the Shema in Hebrew and read it in Greek. And he manages to deal with all those challenges. Okay, our final stop in Eretz Yisrael is Ashkelon. Ashkelon on the coast. Ashkelon was a very important economic powerhouse. It's a port city. It's a mixed city like Caesarea, like Akko, like Yafo. There's Jews living there in a Gentile city. And on the one hand, we hear about witches. Now we have a long and complicated story in the Yerushalmi and Sanhedrin about Shimon ben Shetach, right? Very early times before the Mishnah, who hanged 80 women in Ashkelon as witches. There's a lot of Avodah Zarah. Hey, we hear about the houses of Avodah Zarah in Ashkelon. But on the other hand, we have the very famous story of Dama ben Netina, who's the exemplar of Kibud Av Va'em. Right? He's the guy who has this very important precious stone, and the rabbis come to him, but his father is sleeping. He won't wake him up, right? We all know the story. And he's considered to be the guy who is the example of Kibud Av Va'em. So a place that has two types of people, two types of Gentiles. Okay. We're going to get a little bit into outside of Israel. We won't get to everything. I am very much miscalculating in this series, I have to say, thinking that things will go faster than they will, but lo nora. Rabbi Kalman is happy because this will go on longer than I had
That's the way it
planned.
always goes
Okay,
in
so
Israel,
let's
period.
cross
Let
the
move on.
Yarden. What? All right, let's cross the Yarden. We talked about this last time. We talked about the three lands, right? The Shalosh Medinot, Judea, the Galilee, and Eber HaYarden. Eber HaYarden is a very weird place, right? Is it Eretz Israel? Is it not Eretz Israel? We just started Sefer Devarim last week. Moshe's going to die in Eber HaYarden. We always say Moshe doesn't make it into the land of Israel. But we also know 2.5 tribes, right? Gad and Reuven and Chatzi Menashe are in Eber HaYarden. So it's sort of in Eretz Israel. It's sort of not. It's shared, if you look at the map on the left, between those 2.5 tribes. Shared is probably not a good word, right? Conflicts on and off throughout by Rishon times between those tribes and Ammon, Moab, and Edom, eventually Aram, right? A lot of challenges to the sovereignty of the Jews from Eber HaYarden, but you also have Jews living there. In Second Temple times, by the time we get to Herod conquers Eber HaYarden, and the southern part of the Transjordan becomes a place called Perea. That's where Jews are living. It's an important place in Second Temple times. It's not only a place where Jews live, it's also a place where Jews travel through. Because as we talked about last time, we talked about the Shomron, right? Samaria. Jews who were coming from the Galilee to Jerusalem didn't always want to travel through Samaria. It was not a very friendly place. So what they would do sometimes is cross the Yarden, come down through Perea, cross back near Jericho, and then go on the Jericho-Jerusalem highway, go up to Yerushalayim. Okay, we have a famous story in the New Testament about the Good Samaritan, right? Complicated story, but it takes place along this road of the Jerusalem-Jericho highway. By the time we get to later, in the time of the Mishnah, after Bar Kokhba times, Perea is mostly not Jewish. It's become much more pagan than Christian, becomes very important in Byzantine times, a lot of churches in Transjordan, and we hear less and less about Jewish communities there. But it is part of our story. The Jordan itself, let's go back to the Jordan itself, right? Here's the Jordan. Jordan itself is one of our ways to come into the land of Israel. If you're coming from the east, right? You could be coming from Jordan. You could also be coming from Babel. You might be coming overland. We're going to take a look at this in a little while, how you would come into Eretz Israel from north, but you might also come in and cross the Yarden, whether here or further down, right? You could cross over. One of the people who crosses the Yarden, very famous immigrant, is Rabbi Zeira. Okay? Rabbi Zeira is a very interesting character. He is born in Babel. He lives in Babel, but he wants to go to Eretz Israel. He's always eager to hear the Torah of Eretz Israel when the rabbis come to Babylonia. He wants to hear, what did this one say? What did that one say? Right? He wants to come to the land of Israel and learn there. His problem is that his teacher is Rabbi Yehuda, who forbids him from going. He says, until the Messiah comes, the Jews are not supposed to go up to the land of Israel, right? The three Shavuot, very, very interesting question. Why does he say this? But Rabbi Zeira finally goes, he kind of gets away from Rav Yehuda, and he goes and he gets to the Jordan, and he's going to cross. And we have the story at the end of Ketubot, At the end of Ketubot, we have a lot of praise of the land of Israel. And this is one of the stories, right? So we have when Rabbi Zeira ascended to Eretz Israel, he could not find a ferry to cross the Jordan River. He took hold of a rope that was strung across as a makeshift bridge and crossed the Jordan. What does this mean? It means there was kind of like the Jordan is not very wide, eh, depending on where you are and the time of the year. And instead of having a ferry to take you across, somebody had strung up what we would call like a zip line, right? An omega we have in Israel. And he held onto it and he kind of made his way on the rocks across. Now, what's fascinating is what you're looking at in the picture here. This is a mosaic floor from a town in Jordan called Medva. It was discovered in the 19th century and it's very famous. Most people have seen the image of Jerusalem on this map, but there's other parts as well. And here we have this great depiction of the Jordan with nice big fish in it as it's going down towards the Dead Sea. But take a look at what's over here on the side. Okay? This is a Matzrah. This is the rope that is going across the Jordan so that people can cross. Rabbi Zeira used it hundreds of years later. It's still being used. It's a great detail, right, that shows us the truth of the story. Right? Now, just to continue the story, a certain Sadducee said to him, "Hasty people who put your mouths before your ears, you Jews, you're always rushing into things. You said at the time of the giving of the Torah, 'We will do before we will hear,' right? Na'aseh v'nishma. You remain hasty to this day. Why couldn't you wait a little longer to cross the river on the ferry? Well, what are you doing crossing in this crazy way? What if you fell in? What if someone had to rescue you? You're so I'm a paziza. You're so abrupt. You do things without thinking." Rabbi Zeira said to him, "This place where Moses and Aaron did not merit entering, who is to say that I will merit? I gotta get in fast. Who knows what's gonna happen? I might not make it into Eretz Israel. I gotta cross any way that I can." And Rabbi Zeira is somebody who wants very much to be in the land of Israel. Being in the land of Israel is his ultimate desire. Okay? When he ascended from Babylonia to Eretz Israel, he fasted 100 fasts that he would forget the Babylonian method of studying Gemara so it would not hinder him from adapting to the unique style of study prevalent in Eretz Israel. He doesn't even want to remember the Torah he learned in Babel. Now, he has many adventures as a new immigrant. Anyone who's a new immigrant who's listening can identify very much with Rabbi Zeira. He gets cheated in the marketplace. People make fun of him. He's got all kinds of things. We talked about Dr. Benny Gesundheit before. He has a great piece on Rabbi Zeira as the immigrant. But ultimately, Eretz Yisrael accepts Rabbi Zeira, and we have this beautiful hesped, this beautiful eulogy for him when he dies. The land of Shinar, which is Babylonia, conceived and gave birth to him. But the land of beauty, Eretz Yisrael, right, Eretz HaTzvi, raised the darling of Babylonia. It's one of these very over-the-top eulogies that they would say. But it's very true of Rabbi Zeira. So Rabbi Zeira is one of these immigrants. And from Rabbi Zeira, we'll go to another way of entering Eretz Yisrael. Okay, the picture on the left, anyone who's toured around in Israel has probably gone to Rosh HaNekrah. All the way, the northernmost point on the coast, you have this dramatic, dramatic cliff with these grottos, right? It was a natural boundary, a natural landmark. The rabbis talk about it. It was not the easiest way to come into the land if you were coming from the north from Babylonia, but sometimes people would go in that way. Okay, if you look at the last source over here, Rav Nachman said to Chama Bar Adda, emissary of Tzion, right? We're going to see there are people who traveled back and forth from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. And Rav Nachman asked a favor of this guy who's going back and forth. He says, when you go up there, take a roundabout route and go to the Ladder of Tyres, Sulama Shel Tzor. That's what Rosh HaNekrah was called in the language of the rabbis. Go to Rabbi Yaakov Bar Idi, who lives in Tyre and raises dilemma before him. Listen, you're making this journey. Do me a favor. Take a few days out of the way, okay? And go pass by Tzor and ask Rabbi Yaakov Bar Idi this question that I need asked, right? It tells us something about Rabbi Yaakov Bar Idi that he's worth a few days of a detour, but it also tells us it's another way to travel, okay? And the rabbis saw this as the border of Eretz Yisrael and Tyre and Sidon, right? The land of the Phoenicians, what we call today Lebanon, a lot in the news today. Take a look at the first source here. Rabbi Levi said, when Avram was traveling through Aram Naharaim and Aram Nahor, right? Avram coming from or Kastim, right? Eventually making his way to Eretz Canaan, he saw them eating, drinking, and reveling. He said, "Would that my portion not be in this land." He doesn't like these people. When he reached the Tyrian ladder, he saw them engaged in weeding at the time of weeding, hoeing at the time of hoeing. He said, "Would that my portion be in this land." These are serious people. These are guys who know what how to spend their time. The Holy One, blessed be He, said to him, "To your descendants I will give this land." All right, Abraham, you chose correctly, right? And one last thing, we know that there's an important road, another important road, this time between Achziv, okay, Achziv or Kziv, as it's called in the Torah, okay, Achziv and Akko and this Sulamash shel Tzor. It's an important road in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara. It's an important road many centuries later. The Ramban travels on this road, and we know that he travels on this road because a seal was found that says on it, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, on this road. Okay? But here we have Rabban Gamliel traveling on this road. When he was leaving Achziv, there came a person to ask about a vow, right? Somebody wants Rabban Gamliel to annul his vow. He asked his travel companion, "Would you say that we drank a ravine of Italian wine?" Right? If you drink wine, you're not allowed to judge. So he wants to know, did I drink enough wine that I shouldn't be judging, that I'm technically considered, it's the breathalyzer of the ancient world? He said to him, yes. He told the person who asked, walk with us until we dissipate our wine, right? You want to get rid of the wine, you want to not be hungover, keep walking, and then I'll be able to judge your case. When they came to the Tyrian ladder, Rabban Gamliel dismounted, covered himself, sat down, and dissolved his vow. Okay, so again, important road that we have as we're traveling out of the land of Israel. Okay, let's try to do two more things and we'll leave the rest of Babylonia for next time. Okay, we have two empires here, and this is important to understand. Eretz Israel is on the eastern edge of the Roman Empire. It's on the western edge of the Parthian Empire. Okay? And if you take a look, Parthian eventually becomes Sasanian, and we'll talk about that next time. Okay? If you take a look at the map here on the right, this is the Roman Empire, right? In the time of the Mishnah, in the time of the Gemara, it's encompassing quite a lot, right? But certainly all of the Mediterranean, from the area of Rome, right, going up towards France, towards Spain, North Africa, and coming all the way over to Asia Minor and to Eretz Israel. Okay, so here's Eretz Israel in red, and we are part of the Roman Empire here in Eretz Israel, but we're on the edge, we're on the border. What's just to the east of us? The Parthian Empire, this other major empire that includes Babylonia, but at its height goes all the way to Pakistan. It's enormous. And it's important for us to understand this because we often assume that everything is happening under the Roman Empire. It's not. Okay, the Babylonian rabbis are not living under the Roman Empire. It's a different government. It's a different language. It's a different coinage. It's a different religion. It's different customs. Many, many things are different. We know a lot more about the Roman Empire and about life under the Roman Empire than we know about life in Babylonia. And we often conflate what's going on in Babylonia with what's going on in Eretz Israel. So we have to be aware of that. We can't always answer those questions, but we do have to be aware of that. Now, the rabbis know this as well, and we have a lot of statements that we're going to see about both these rulers. This is a great one here in Pesachim. The Holy One, blessed be He, Kadosh Baruch Hu, knows the Jewish people who are unable to withstand the harsh decrees of the Romans. Therefore, he exiled them to Babylonia. And this is a question that we often ask in Jewish history. Now, who had it worse? What situation was it worse under the Crusades or in the Inquisition? Was it worse under the Romans or in the Babylonians? Right? It's Jewish history, unfortunately, has many, many examples. We are going to see that even though we talk a lot about the harsh decrees of the Romans, we're also going to have some trouble with the Babylonians and It can go both ways. Okay, I want to start the next topic quickly. We might start again with it next time, just in case. But we have a lot of travelers back and forth. Okay, it seems incomprehensible to us today because we talk about Babylonia, we're talking about Iran. Yes, missiles can reach to us from there. We are so aware of that in these days. But still, to us, it's the other side of the moon. How could you possibly travel from the land of Israel to Iran? You would never do such a thing. Okay. How far is it? Again, Google Maps, very useful. Approximately 1,500 kilometers, approximately 2 weeks of walking. Okay? Google Maps will actually chart out for you a driving route, but don't try this at home. Okay. So 2 weeks of walking, that's not so much. And there are caravans that go and people who traveled back and forth. Okay. In the beginning, when the academies in Jerusalem, not in Jerusalem, when the academies in Eretz Israel are at their height, right, in the time of the Tanaim, the rabbis are coming from Babylonia to learn at the great Batei Midrash in the land of Israel. Rabbi Chiya brings his nephew Rav, okay, and they are coming to learn in Eretz Israel. Eventually, the academies in Babylonia are going to surpass those in Eretz Israel, and rabbis from the land of Israel are going to come to Babylonia, but they're also going to be bringing Torah. We have travelers back and forth, up and down, okay? Because Babylonia is down and Eretz Yisrael is up. We always ascend to Eretz Yisrael, but also physically, Babylonia is down by the valleys. And we're going to talk about these travelers, these descenders who are called the Nechute. We're going to get to that next time. Now, so you have sources that we're not getting to. Do not fear. We will get to them next time. Okay. Let's take a look at the many comments that we have here and see if there's anything that we need to address. Okay. Sources. Okay. Yeah. Rabbi Yochanan doesn't say Hebrew for poetry. It's true, right? What are his criteria? Presumably, Yonatan, excuse me, not Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yonatan. Presumably, he wants people to be speaking Hebrew, but Greek was more a poetry, a bigger audience in Greek, interesting, right? We want to have more people buy our poetry books, maybe. Okay, Israelis are destroying the language. Oh, that's not so nice. Hey, Moroccans and other Sephardim, yeah, Aleph and Ayin, the Ashkenazim messed it up completely, right? But Aleph and Ayin are supposed to be two different letters, Hey and Chet as well. Okay, they mispronounce verbs. Yes, that's true. Okay, changes in pronunciation. I'm not saying it's necessarily bad, but just to point out that there is a richness to the letters. They are not the same letters. Okay, when did they date the mosaic from Lod? The mosaic from Lod is 3rd century of the Common Era. Okay, maybe you didn't want to teach that subject. Yeah, like I said, it's a strange Gemara. I don't have any great answers. The Nahardah is the Nahardah in Babylonia, and we are going to get to Nahardah next time. Okay. And yes, obviously we have native prejudice or cheerleading, right? Everybody always says, oh, I live in Alon Shvut. It's the greatest place in the world, right? You can ask anyone in Alon Shvut, they will tell you that's true, right? But yes, for sure, there's always people who are going to be cheerleaders for their region and not for other regions. Okay, 1.5 to 2 hours. Yes, thank you. That's exactly what we're saying, right? That's the distance it would take to walk from Tveria to Migdal. But yes, of course, depends on the weather. If it's hot, if you put it in your bed with your electric blanket on, as some people do. Okay. Yes, and yeast was definitely slower in those days. There were bridges. Were there bridges over the Yarden? It does not seem there were definitely bridges, right? And certainly in places like Babylonia, which has canals and bridges all over the place, there are bridges. When we hear about the Yarden, usually we're talking about ferries, right? They're usually crossing on ferries. Did they have bridges other than these very rude bridges? I don't know of terms like that, but it could be that I'm wrong. Okay. Oh, very nice. Podcast of Jewish Ideas. Shai Sikander. Yeah, Shai Sikander is amazing. He knows tons. Definitely, if you want to get more or get an introduction to what we're going to talk about next time, the Zoroastrians on introduction. He knows much more than I do. So you can hear the most from him and then hear the introduction from me. Persia, yes. We'll get to a map of Babylonia next time. Okay. Ma'abarot HaYarden is crossing points of the Jordan. It's not necessarily a bridge. It's a place where you could cross. Okay. Could there have been bridges at different times? Yes. Bridges are something that get washed away also when there are floods. So realize that bridges don't necessarily last forever. So that's also something to keep in mind. Other questions, other comments? Okay.
Did the Ardennes ever flood?
Of course, the Yarden for sure floods in the springtime. Hey, in fact, just as recently as like 10 years ago, you go to the southern part of the Yarden to what's called Qasr al-Yehud, which we think is the crossing point of the Jews with Yehoshua. There was a flood there, and they have a marker on the wall of how high it was. It was a good, I don't know, 5, 6 meters high. So yes, it definitely does. Oh, thank you, Ruth. Fording, that is definitely the word that we wanted that I was not coming up with.
Okay.
Okay, other questions, other comments? Okay,
All right,
thank
off
you.
air.
Thank
We'll
you,
stay
Rabbi
talking. We'll see
Kalman.
you next week. Okay, and it's
Thank
okay.
you.
Take care.
Thank you, truly.
Yeah,
Amazing.
thank you.
Thank
Thank
you.
you. Not next week, the week after.
Oh, yes, thank you. Please remind everybody, Rabbi
That's right.
Kalman, not
Thank you
next
very
week.
much. It is on the website, of course, but thank you. I didn't really, of course, in 2 weeks, please God, we will, please God, send out an email next Thursday morning, also reminding people not to show up. But anyways, okay. As I mentioned in the beginning, 8:30 tonight, our Parsha Shiur, of course, Rav Avia Tabori. As we mentioned, a neighbor of Shuli's in Alon Shvut. I guess lots of people do think it's the greatest place in the world to live. And tomorrow, my shiur on the Seder 9:15, Rabbi Liebtag Sunday morning at 11:15. And of course, Shiur Bivrit, as we were discussing in Dr. Benny Gesundheit at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday. Okay, everybody be well. We should hear good news. And okay, have a
Thank you,
wonderful
Julie.
Thank you.